Welcome to Best Picture This, where it is always Oscar season. I'm Mike.
And I'm Brian. In this show, we reevaluate every Best Picture nominee from the 21st century and decide whether to keep it or kick it from its Oscar pedestal.
That's right. And today we blew the budget to make the most expensive podcast episode ever recorded to talk about a movie that was, at the time, the most expensive movie ever made. The film is, of course, Avatar, directed by James Cameron, and it made over $2.7 billion at the box office. I'm expecting similar returns from this episode.
I think so.
From our discussion about a big moneymaker.
Even 10%, I would be fine with.
Yeah, just make sure you bring your A game, Brian. And here's the trailer.
You Jake Sully? I'd like to talk to you about a fresh start on a new world. You'd be making a difference.
I became a Marine for the hardship. I told myself I can pass any test a man can pass. All I ever wanted was a single thing worth fighting for.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are not in Kansas anymore. You are on Pandora.
You should see your faces.
We have an indigenous population called the Na'vi. They are very hard to kill.
This is why we're here.
Because this little gray rock sells for 20 million a kilo. Their village happens to be resting on the richest deposit, and they need to relocate. Those savages are threatening our whole operation. We're on the brink of war, and you're supposed to be finding a diplomatic solution.
The concept is to drive these remotely controlled bodies called avatars. They're grown from human DNA mixed with DNA of the natives.
Marine in an avatar body. That's a potent mix.
You get me what I need, I'll see to it you get your legs, babe. Your real legs.
Hell yeah, sir.
Looks like you. This is your avatar.
Just relax and let your mind go blank. It shouldn't be hard for you.
Simple. I want you to learn from the inside. I want you to gain their trust.
You should not be here.
Go back. All this is your fault.
I need your help.
Stopping him.
We're going up against gunships with bows and arrows.
Well, I guess we better stop him.
They've sent us a message that they can take whatever they want. But we will send them a message.
This is our land!
So I recently watched, in my own time, not on Best Picture this time.
Good.
I recently watched a very similar film called Persona by Ingmar Bergman. Have you watched it?
Not yet. Very similar film.
Yeah. It struck me, it might be the exact opposite of this movie, but it struck me as I was watching, I've never watched anything by Ingmar Bergman, that there were zero cliches in the movie. There wasn't one shot that was a cliche that I felt. There wasn't one line in it that seemed like a cliche. The lighting was all interesting and weird. Everything was totally fresh.
Uh-huh.
And then I think that almost every single line in this movie is a cliche.
I'm glad to hear you
say
that.
Isn't that kind of interesting?
I'm definitely glad to hear this. Because going into this, You made some comments about being excited about, and I didn't know if you...
I still am. There's some things that I'm very excited about.
And that's fine, and that's fine. But I came in here kind of worried, like...
You thought you were going to have to talk me down?
Yeah. Like, yeah. Does he not see what's going on here? And a lot of them are featured in that trailer, which I feel like we just watched the movie, listening to that.
The trailer, I mean, there's a certain magic in this movie that the trailer, at least listening to it, does zero for you. I mean, so much, there's hardly any single moment line of dialogue that is memorable or even very good, you know, in throughout the movie. But anyway, so this movie though, very successful. It won 3 Academy Awards, cinematography, visual effects, art direction. If it didn't win visual effects, I mean, there'd be a little problem, I think.
Yeah.
Because I think that's really what it was going for. But, I mean, James Cameron is going for a whole lot more than just special effects. He was nominated for director. I mean, he's stated, like, he wants this to be like, I mean, there's going to be like 6 movies. He wants it to be like the new... He's
dedicating basically the rest of his career to this franchise.
Anyway, nominated for a lot of other things. Best picture, directing, editing, music, sound. It was made for $237 million. The box office number I saw was $2.9 billion. Broke all kinds of records. Avatar remained, which was crazy because it actually broke records set by Cameron also in Titanic.
Yeah.
And then Avatar remained the highest grossing film for almost a decade until Avengers Endgame came out. But then there was a re-release in China of Avatar, and then that pumped it back up. So it's still the number one.
Okay.
We got Avatar 3 coming out in 2024, skipping right over Avatar 2, which is in theaters. I haven't seen it yet. Avatar 4 is coming out in 2026. Avatar 5 in 2028, assuming everything goes well. Rotten Tomatoes, 82. Metacritic, 83. It got a 29-hour ovation.
Yeah. Okay.
we'll talk about questions, trivia. And of course, Keep It or Kick It could get a little interesting.
It could. Speaking of the cliches, though, this is my first question, A.
Okay.
Why does Sigourney Weaver hate this guy when he shows up?
Because in every... because it's part of the cliche of filmmaking.
It just has to be... It's like... He has to face...
You have to...
Flack.
Yes. Yep. You have to dislike the person that you're eventually going to team up with.
It bothered me
same thing
more
with,
than usual in this one, though, because they have this really expensive avatar that they cannot use without this guy. So it's either he uses it or they throw it in the trash or something.
So why would you want to just be a jerk to him from the very beginning?
Yeah, it makes no sense. But that's not my question. My question is that you can't talk about this movie without talking about the technical elements, the achievement of it. Mm-hmm. And going into this, I hadn't seen it since my first and only watch in 2012.
Me too.
I didn't see it in theater.
I saw it in the theater and that was the only time I ever saw it.
I saw it on a TV. And I remember going into this that it looked really cool on the TV. But on this watch, I realized my TV in 2012 was not equipped to kind of screen this the way that it's meant to be seen.
Yeah.
The visuals.
So you now have a 4K?
I have a 4K.
And it held up.
Yeah. The visuals look very good. Yeah. And I think that the visuals are the story in a lot of this movie. So with that in mind, do you have a favorite act or a sequence, something that is memorable, that sticks with you the most, and how important are the visuals in that memory?
I think that far and away, the most engaging parts of the movie are the visuals. I mean, the main character walking through that dangly light up tree, you know, very cool. I think just seeing all the, like the weird animals on Pandora, I mean, seeing the floating mountains, like throughout there's every time you're in Pandora, there's like something new and exciting to see. And I didn't even see this in 3D. But at the end, toward the end of the movie, you know, you have this arrow pointed like almost right at you. And when it's released, I sort of halfway jumped.
Like the black and white train coming at the audience. Yeah,
it wasn't even in 3D and I still sort of jumped. Like I was totally immersed in the visual effects and in the world of it.
It sounds like we're on a similar page here, because what I kind of noticed going into this is that this is a movie that's kind of comprised 100% of set pieces. It's not like you have I mean, you do have dialogue scenes that are, you know, the interconnective tissue.
Yeah.
But it's sort of just you go from one giant set piece to the next giant set piece, and the dialogue is almost just there in service to explain why we're experiencing whatever it is that Cameron is showing us in that sequence. And for me, same thing, that kind of welcome to Pandora sequence where he kind of gets separated from his crew, and then he meets the girl, Natiri. That how you pronounce
something
her name?
Something like that, yeah.
And she sort of shows him the land the way that the natives see it, instead of it being very threatening. And you get those kind of air jellyfish. You get the plants that sort of suck into themselves when you touch them. And it's just one thing after another.
These big rhinoceros-type monsters.
Yeah. You know,
and little, like, these other, like, very vicious-looking dogs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always something inventive and imaginative.
Yeah.
And that I appreciate.
Totally.
I'm starting off positives.
Here's my golden take on this movie. This is basically like Pirates of the Caribbean in reverse. Like, it's almost like this movie was made to become a theme park attraction.
Yeah.
And Pirates was a theme park attraction that turned into a movie.
I think here what gives this a little bit of extra life is that the whole innovation of the camera work, you know, the camera is free during all of these set pieces to glide throughout these scenes, which we hadn't really seen beforehand, before this movie. You know, you were stuck to physical form, and in this it's virtual cameras.
I think that there are a lot of pretty heavy special effects movies. I mean, I kept thinking a lot about Lord of the Rings trilogy while I was watching this. And again, I think that that's kind of what James Cameron's trying to do, is like invent his own kind of, mythological level kind of world that people would appreciate in the same way they did there.
Yeah. I think the difference there, though, is you still have the setup shots in Lord of the Rings, where we kind of see the huge city from afar. And then we zoom in to the characters, and they might be on a green screen, but we're not kind of in the world of that green screen like we are here. Mm-hmm. This movie is 60% CGI, and you have actors who are, you know, shot in motion with their ping pong balls and everything like that. And sometimes there's real environment elements built in, but a lot of times it's not, and the camera is operated virtually. Cameron described it as, it's like a big, powerful game engine. If I want to fly through space or change my perspective, I can. I can turn the whole scene into a living miniature and go through it on a 50-to-1 scale. And Peter Jackson is actually using miniatures.
Yeah.
So I think that's the difference. There's an immersion level here that there isn't in movies before it.
It's true. So this movie is directed by, written by, co-produced by, co-edited by James Cameron. Is that partly why the film feels like is it one guy kind of stroking his ego, and this is what we come up with? That's a very uncharitable way to think about this, but I kind of wonder if like all the cliches like piling on top of each other is like, he's in control of the whole thing, and it just so happens that, you know, that's the type of writer that he is, and so that's what you come up with. It almost feels a little bit like the problem with George Lucas having a little too much power in Star Wars, and then you get these, you know, flawed episodes 1, 2, 3.
Mm-hmm.
I know we have different opinions about episode 3.
Yeah, episode 3 is a masterpiece.
But you have I don't know. It's almost like a little bit hokey.
You
know?
Oh, for sure.
Like the mineral that they're looking for is called unobtainium. I mean, is no one saying like, James, I mean, that's kind of good.
You can't obtain it though. It's hard to obtain.
Did you not
put the piece?
Now I get that. Yeah. He said that he wrote the story drawing inspiration from, quote, every single science fiction book, unquote, he had ever read in his childhood.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if that's like the thing to brag about or if, I don't know, but yet at the same time, I think that he sees it as a positive. Like I'm turning this mythology thing. I'm drawing on everything, and it's going to all resonate because I'm getting at the primal, you know, story level, like the Joseph Campbell kind of, you know, approach to storytelling. I think that maybe is what he's going for. The Na'vi language, they came up with 1,000 words for it, and
Does that impress
Cameron,
you?
Cameron added 30 of his own.
Does that do anything for you when you hear about it? Yeah,
no, it doesn't.
I couldn't care less about that with movies.
But there's so much like...
Is that a me problem?
I don't know. But there's so many like... There's so much attention to the detail that I think it just speaks again to his ambition with it.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been thinking about making this for years, ever since basically Titanic. But he wanted there to be these humanoid people that never, you know, you had to have the right technology for it, and it just never happened. So then when he finally got there, he got there. Cameron's mother had a dream, and she saw these like blue skinned people, and so it's like, yeah, let's make them blue. And that, I don't know, at one hand it feels kind of like haphazard tinkering, hobbyish, and then other hand it's like mythological ambition. So I'm like, is this part of the flaw, is like Cameron's too in charge to see some of the, you know, cliches.
We're crossing over again, like we seem to do a lot with second questions. Let me just list off some of these. I think the movie's kind of built on these models of archetypes. So you have the macho, war-hungry Marine.
Yeah.
Very grizzled.
He could have gotten that scar taken care of. I kind of like that.
I kind of like it. The greedy corporate suit. You got the scientists fighting for control of their department. The military guys tells Jake, the main character at one point, you walk like one or her science pukes. You quack like one, but you report to me. Ugh, I hate that line so much.
Genius.
But I guess where I was approaching all this from was not so much is it a Cameron having too much control problem, or is it that the story and the dialogue are almost meant to be secondary in a story like this that's so spectacle-based. The movie is so much about the visuals that it's almost... Is it a problem that they didn't pay enough attention to the dialogue, or are we kind of not supposed to care because we're so wrapped up into the world and these dragons and the nerve endings on the tails that you can connect to things? And I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like...
Or is that an excuse?
I feel like ultimately the movie is trying to be the biggest, hugest thrill ride you've ever been on.
Mm-hmm.
It seems kind of a wasted opportunity to not also make it like more thought provoking.
Yeah. And the story is, you know, based off of the Native Americans and us just coming in. And so maybe there was a thought that was a little deeper than it is.
It's touching on all kinds of things that you could, but that's just not where the emotional payoffs of the movie are. You know, they're all kind of like, just stitching together the physical thrills. I was going to bring a copy. There's actually a 225 page book. That's like a field guide, a confidential report on the biological and social history of Pandora. That was another artifact from the myth making.
You going to read that?
I think that would be interesting. Yeah, I'd like to know about the flora and the fauna.
Another Ebert quote that I love is that he said that movies are not about what they're about how they're about. And this is a prime example of that, right? Because it's kind of about its technical achievement. And I guess it just comes down to, is that enough for you? And for me... Although I do love the ambition and I was into the spectacle of it, I kind of enjoyed this as an experience on a whole. Mm-hmm. I think it's telling when...
You enjoyed it as an experience.
I enjoyed it
on the whole.
As an experience.
Is that not satisfactory?
That's fine. Yeah. That's fine. But is that something I get excited about and I would tell people, you got to rush out and see this? No. It's just that watching it, I thought, okay, great, fine. And then turn the TV off, go to sleep. Forget it ever happened. And I think it's telling, if you get to the final climax of a movie and you check out, that sort of tells you how much the thing has been working on you. And here I was completely checked out for like the last 30 to 45 minutes during that battle.
The battle scene is a little
similar for
a little bit long. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I just wasn't, it just feels kind of predictable, like you know how it's going to go. I do wish that I could have seen it in Korea, though. They released a 4D version. Did you hear about this?
4D?
4D. Seats move. You can smell explosives. They're sprinkling water, you know, on you in the audience.
Okay.
There's laser lights. There's wind, you know, blowing in the theater.
Hmm.
That'd be kind of cool.
Embracing that theme
and
park
course,
element.
And exactly. I mean, that's the thing. Like the more real, it's already almost like a physical sensation when you're watching it. And I think that is very unusual accomplishment for any movie that I've ever seen.
You never get off of a roller coaster and say, I wish that story was better before it shot us out of the tube.
Exactly.
And that's what's going on here. I know, think.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. So yeah, anyway, this is what, I mean, I think you kind of have to just decide how successful is that as a movie then. I will tell you this though. I definitely want to see the second Avatar in the theater.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
I haven't yet, but I
really
want to.
If I could see it on IMAX in 3D, the way it's intended, 3D, yeah. I would be game. I'm kind of thinking that's not going to happen though now because Christmas is coming up. I'm not going to see it in the next 2 days.
Why not?
Am I going to make, is it going to still be in IMAX by the time?
It doesn't have to be in IMAX.
In a movie like this, I really feel like you're shortchanging it if you don't see it.
You could watch it on your phone with those 3D glasses. It'd still be good.
You can go on Space Mountain. It's the same as if you just look at a YouTube video of Space Mountain on your phone,
yeah,
right?
Might be.
Same actually. Experience.
You want to hear a little trivia?
Yeah.
All right. So, Sam Worthington was apparently living in his car at the time of the audition. He wanted to pluck somebody out who was less known. Although maybe that's part of the excuse, like we wanted to get somebody famous, but we couldn't. Who knows? But I think big movies that are like, you know, like Daniel Radcliffe, like no one knew who he was. You don't want to have a famous person as a famous character sometimes. So although they did offer the role to Matt Damon, offered him 10% in the film's profits, turned it down because he was doing the Bourne movies.
Wow, 10%.
You could have had a pretty good payoff.
That would have been huge.
Let's see. So in preparation for some of the sequences, all the actors had professional training specific to their characters. Archery, horseback riding, firearm use. They all got trained in the Na'vi language. They got sent to the Hawaiian rainforest. They get a feel for the rainforest setting before you went back to the soundstage.
Okay.
Method, man. You got to go to the rainforest if you're ever going to be in a rainforest movie.
I guess.
He also would only allow plant-based food on the set because this is about climate. You know, it's about climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Get people in the mood. The firepower of these computers in 2009, they're maxing out anything possible. You know, they're like, give me 10% more. I can't, you know, it's like a scene in Star Trek. It would take several hours to render a single frame. Just took forever. The magnitude of what he's trying to do is just, I don't know, maybe
unprecedented.
Maybe the biggest movie ever attempted at the time, especially.
And what's amazing to me about Cameron is that he keeps doing this and then he keeps hitting home runs. There's some mad genius element going on there where he spends what seems like way too much money on the Titanic.
When are we going to get a Titanic 2? That's my question.
Hey, maybe it'll happen. But then, you know, it's incredibly profitable. And then he does it again with Avatar. And I don't know, I haven't seen yet if Avatar 2 is really raking it in at the box office. But I expected it would.
Yeah. It wasn't like the first weekend wasn't as huge in the U.S. as some people were hoping or expecting. But it was still really big worldwide. And I'm sure it'll be big. Who knows if it'll be as big as the first one. So keep it or kick it, Mike.
I have to say it's an easy kick for me, an easy kick. I am glad that I rewatched it on my good TV because I do think that it deserves that. And looking back at 2009 effects, they still hold up. I'm sure this new one would look 10 times better, and I wouldn't even notice that until I look at them side by side. Mm-hmm. But it was a better experience for sure. But top five, even in a bad year, it's not going to make it. How about
you? So Richard Corliss of Time said that he thought the film was, quote, the most vivid and convincing creation of a fantasy world ever seen in the history of moving pictures, unquote.
Big words.
Big words. I have to say that when I first, when this was on the list, I thought it had no shot. But right now, I think that it is a keeper. Mm. And it is a temptation to stay in my top five. Just because of the experience I had in it. Like, I was really, I was loving the visuals. And, like, I was, like, willing to ignore a lot of this other stuff. Until, of course, we get here, and now we're starting to badmouth it. But I don't know. The experience of it, I thought, was great. I was sort of, like, I was kind of, like, I don't know. In a way, I was sort of happy for James Cameron that he pulled this off. You know, despite against the flaws.
A true underdog story for James Cameron. You love to see it. But I said something similar after The Batman, that I really liked The Batman a lot. Mm-hmm. Love the experience of it. Love the visual style, the aesthetic. Big fan. But hated the length. I thought, this thing's got to tighten up. Mm-hmm. You know, there are ways to cut. And it seems kind of ridiculous to say, chop an hour off of a movie because you're making it fundamentally a different movie. But The Batman, the same as Avatar, I kind of think that I would have left excited if the movie were shorter and I was just kind of soaking up all those visuals the whole time and wowed. And then it ends and it leaves me wanting more. Rather instead, the last 30 minutes, I'm zoned out. I've already seen the spectacle. So just kind of adding explosions to it in a battle scene doesn't really do it for me. Mm-hmm. And it kind of overstays its welcome a little bit. So could you cut an hour off of Avatar? We already
what
said
do you
the
do?
Story
you lose
is...
the flying dragons. You lose the horses. What do you lose?
You would definitely have to lose some stuff. I wouldn't want to lose the.
I don't want to lose any of that.
I wouldn't want to lose the beginning where we're kind of meeting this land, but. We sort of came into this thing agreeing that these characters are not richly written, that the dialogue is not good, that the storyline is not unique, that the romance doesn't work. So why are we holding on to that stuff?
There's something about, like, when Jake, the paralytic, gets into a body and is running through the woods.
Again, that's first act stuff.
I'm into it.
I'm in. You got me in the first act.
When Sigourney Weaver's character dies instead of being transferred fully into her avatar, you kind of know that he's going to succeed later on.
Yeah, that's just a setup.
But when he does succeed, it's like, I'm all into it. I thought it was a cool, a great moment.
So cut from the first act to him going into the body and just throw in a half an hour of stuff in the middle about, you know, the U.S. saying, all right, we don't need to be jerks. You can keep your land. Wrap it up.
You may have a future in filmmaking. You may.
You have to be harsh with these edits.
Coming up in the next episode, we're going to talk about Crazy Heart, which was not nominated for Best Picture, but... did, I believe, won for Best Actor Jeff Bridges.
Yes.
Playing a washed-up country singer.
Until then, find us on social media or wherever you listen. And for 16 years of golden takes, head over to letterboxd.com/Mike Cavalieri.
To support the show, visit patreon.com/bestpicturethis.
And thanks to WNZF and the illustrious Mark Gilliland for producing. Also, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to the show.
Thanks for listening to Best Picture This, the only podcast on the market with... moving seats and smells of explosives.